Thank you, Ann. So you've heard three perspectives, which I think have really illuminated a tremendous amount of territory. The floor is open for questions to the panelists.
Bloomberg Government. These questions are really for Bob and for Ann, but I guess Cliff might want to chime in as well. I did my PhD about 25 years ago in physics, so I like numbers. And I did my PhD at MIT, and then I did postdoc work at Columbia. Back then, I didn't I didn't use a lot of big data, but I did use data. Most of it is sitting on old computer tapes in my basement. As a physicist, I like numbers. I worked on Capitol Hill, and I worked at the White House, and they really like numbers. They like factoids, preferably true, that illustrate the problem. So I have a question. I want a factoid from the three of you. If we look at the research that was published at MIT and Columbia by researchers 5 years ago, how much of the data that those publications were based on is available, first of all, by begging the researcher for the data, and second, in some way that you could get it without having to go on bended knee to the actual researcher? So can you give us a number? You know, how much of the data is just completely lost, and how much is on the other end of the spectrum? How much is right there? You can get it tomorrow. It shouldn't take you more than an hour or two.
I can't tell you for 5 years ago, but there have been some actual organized studies of this. Victoria Stodden has done some work in this area, I believe, as has Heather P. Warr, where they basically went through and systematically requested data from everybody who appeared in, you know, an issue from last year of, I forget whether it was Science or Nature, and looked at how many of them had deposited data in repositories when, you know, that when such things existed in their field, and who would respond to requests for copies of the data. And the numbers aren't happy.
10%?
They were a little better than 10%, but I mean they weren't like up in the 80% or something like that. And we aren't talking about, 5 or 10 year history here. I don't remember the precise numbers, but there is some literature on that that actually could give you some, you know, reasonably rigorous answers.
I can see why this would be a really nice motivating factoid. I mean, does Columbia or MIT do better? I mean, what's your estimate?
Hard to give an estimate. Our campus, Lamont campus, an earth science campus, is home to several community databases. And there, for a community that includes people on the campus but is as much people around the country or around the world, you know, a relatively high percentage of the raw data collected on cruises and things is available, and people will publish from that. Now, if you're talking about the secondary analysis and other data that, you know, came out of a computer program that they did 5 years ago, probably the researcher can't get to it. But the raw data probably is sitting in a community database. And those, you know, that practices have increased. So it's very hard to go campus by campus. At Columbia, they've been building something called the Academic Commons, where the idea is that because people in the old days, they had papers and notes and things that were physical could be archived when they, you know, retired or passed away. I think the library is aware that the digital stuff is just not in the same state and can't be preserved unless it's produced within a framework where the provenance and documentation already exists. So there's efforts, you know, with a very long time frame vision that people at Columbia will be given the tools to start managing their data within a system that will have the potential to basically migrate the data in a preservation context. I think, you know, most campuses are a long way from that, and I couldn't give you a number.
Thank you. I think it's very field specific, actually. It's very hard to generalize at a place like MIT, because we have economists and political scientists who build their own databases and build their labs and their careers and their graduate student success around the very hard, very difficult work of building databases that create a corpus of information that you can mine and continue to build over time. Sometimes the data is not available because the contract didn't require it. So, you know, you have to figure out on what basis was the data acquired, what expectations were there around the data, and sometimes the data isn't available because, frankly, the equipment that it was captured on has been surpassed by other better equipment, and there'd be absolutely no point in keeping it because the world moves on. I remember a conversation with Jerry Friedman, who's one of our Nobel laureates in physics, and I asked him if he still had the data that won him the Nobel Prize, and he said, oh, for heaven's sakes, no. There'd be no point whatsoever in keeping that because the equipment is so much better now. You can get so much more information than you could then. So again, you know, it has to do with it, whether there's a community of interest. There's a database at MIT called PhysioNet, which has measures a personal physiological attributes on an enormous group of people who've come into the Boston area hospitals. It's enormously useful, and the community has banded together, NIH funding, and they've banded together, and they're maintaining it. But it's not just a database. It's a whole set of tools, how you use that data, and it's moved over time. And so it's, you know, it's just very hard to say that every bit of data that's captured out of a research program in a research university needs to be kept, should be kept. So, you know, it's sort of, it's one of those, have you stopped beating your wife yet questions, you know. The answer is, she's not my wife, you know.
Just to comment on that, Rich Roberts did a very clever thing a number of years ago in the biosciences. He created a journal that actually had a database issue where it would be papers about databases, which immediately tells you one thing, that there's no reward for doing a database. There's a reward for the paper that comes about that database, which is a problem we all know about. But what's interesting, because that's open access, you can get all the URLs from those databases, and you can write a little script, and you can go out and you can ping all those databases. And if you do so, if you don't get a response, if you get a 404 error, you come back and you do the same thing a week, 2 weeks, a month later. And what do you find? 1 year, 10% are gone. 2 years, 20% are gone. After 5 years, it kind of plateaus off. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there, for quite a long time, perhaps it's still true, there was money to set up databases, but no money to sustain them. And that's a whole set of other problems.
I actually wanted to comment on your first part, which is the incentive issue. And just to put in a little plug, within the Earth Institute, we have a mission that includes, what we call practice, that is supporting sustainable development, not just in an academic Ivy Tower sense, but getting out in the field. And so there's a subcommittee of the Earth Institute faculty that had developed a set of criteria for promotion for scientists, which includes non-traditional output. So if a scientist spends a year in Haiti working on earthquake prediction and impacts, they're not necessarily penalized for not having produced, you know, half a dozen papers. And this extends to data. So we have included the concept of data outputs, and they still have to be great data sets. I mean, you still have to get 10 letters from outside people saying this is the greatest data set and it's done well and up to standards. But the great thing is the Columbia Provost has approved these. These are actually in practice. They're being used in promotion cases for the past year and tries to kind of, you know, change one of the very important institutional incentive issues that people have mentioned, which is, you know, can you get maybe not tenure, but can you get credit and the equivalent of tenure if you're not in a tenure-track position in a major research university where the standards are quite high. So I just report that as, you know, a data point for hopefully a future development.
We're running a bit late, but I think I'm going to give you the last question before we wind down.
Thank you. I'm Turkan Gardiner from Pragmatica Corporation, and a few words really interested me, and that is common interest and communities. And I'd like to relay a personal experience about two generations ago, perhaps historically as well as computer advancements, that there was an interdisciplinary interest on display rather than analysis, which gave rise to the interest and expansion of the geographic information systems called GIS, which has now become geographical information science. And at that time, over 25 agencies within the federal government contributed data to a system, a GIS system, that was centrally located. And their interest was to see how many common elements are on a state basis, different smaller county basis, census tract basis. And it was really interesting for people to see how many quote-unquote layers could be displayed and overlaid to find out extremes, for example, on epidemiological indices, death indices, cancer indices, and a lot of people got interested in it. Now, the terminology changed from domestic information to domestic decision information. And then the terminology changed to geographic information system to geographic information science. A lot of people started analyzing the data after the fact, after actually seeing the colors of yellow going to red and yellow going to green, et cetera, et cetera. So I totally commend the information that was displayed in the symposium about getting people interested in something that is slightly new to researchers as well as people interested in lots of modules of information that are available from many sources. Thank you.
Anyone want to make a closing comment there? Thank you.